This is the first one with the lost city of Atlantis, people being turned into California rolls, and a mad scientist who isn't the Doctor. It's called The Underwater Menace. Here we go.
We're embarking on a voyage all through time and all through space, counting Daleks, Thalen, Ood, and the Cybertronic race. Santorans look like taters, and Silurians all have wonky scales, and the Doctor has a TARDIS. We're reviewing all his tales. Who back when? Reviewing all of who there is. Who back when? Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please. Episode by episode, we're trudging down this temporal road. Come join us on this odyssey. What other choice could there be than who back when?
Who Back When?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode C032 of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I am Ponkin. Yes, I am. And yes, this is another solo venture into classic Who. Okie dokie, if this is your first time tuning into Who Back When, welcome to the show. I should pre-record this. This solo episode disclaimer and just play it back every single time I do one. Here's the dealio, ladies and gents. You may or may not know there were tons and tons of lost episodes, lost serials, in fact, in Classic Who. And right now, and for a while now, actually, Who Back When has been in the thick of it. I mean, we are in Lost Serial City right now. We are steadily approaching the end of the Lost Serials run, but until we do so, whenever we encounter one of these Lost Serials, I tend to do them as solo eps. So again, if this is your first time listening to Who Back When, normally I sit down with one or two of my friends and we discuss and debate and rate a serial together. So if a discussion is more your bag, then you know what? Check out any other, almost any other, I should say, Who Back When episode. If you don't mind a soliloquy, and I'm going to toot my own horn here, a lot of people have written in and said that these solo eps, these reviews of lost serials, actually really helped them out. Thank you. Seriously, huge thanks for saying so. It really does mean a lot. Some of you out there in podcast land find them really useful in terms of deciding which lost episodes to watch. I mean, quote-unquote watch. To watch the recons of. Others, and I really don't blame you for this, others don't want to take part in the lost serials at all, but they do want to take part in the Who. They want to learn what they've missed out on, and that's where these solo missions come in. So, you know what? If you're sticking around, I don't think it's a total loss, buddy. I'm biased, obviously. Anyway, today I will be reviewing The Underwater Menace. It's a Troughton serial.
Bing bong, Future Ponkin here. Just a super quick note to say that it's a 4-episode arc, and up until recently, or at least as far as I'm aware, up until recently, only episode 3 was actually perfectly intact, so that if you wanted to watch episodes 1, 2, and 4, you'd have to slog through the recon. Turns out that's not exactly the case anymore. More about that when we get to episode 2, though. All right, back to the show.
Okie dokie, let's summarize this serial the way we normally do, with a bite-sized chunk of Who. It's B-Scout time. Bite-sized chunk of Who. The TARDIS materializes on a volcanic island somewhere on Earth. Bada-bing, our intrepid travelers are kidnapped. Dum-dum-dum. Anyway, our intrepid travelers in this case being the Doc, obvi, Ben and Polly, or as if, in case you've listened to our William Hartnell retrospective, as JD would say, Ben and Polly, and Troughton's brand new companion, Jamie McCrimmon, whom we met in the Highlanders. Anyway, they're kidnapped and taken to the lost city of Atlantis, now a subaquatic hellhole where marooned sailors are subjected to horrific plastic surgery against their will. And weirdly, running the show is a mad scientist who isn't the Doctor, namely a Professor Zaroff, whose madcap plan to raise the lost city back from the bottom of the ocean may in fact mean the destruction of the Earth. Holy smokes, guys. Hashtag intense. B-Scout over, you are welcome. Okie dokie. Before I jump into episode 1, here are two pieces of introductory trivia. That's right, ladies and gents. Number 1, this story had 3 working titles during production, namely The Fish People, which sounds pretty Whovian, actually, Doctor Who Under the Sea, which sounds like a Disney on Ice show to me, and, according to TARDIS Wikia, Atlanta. Which, what? Is that a typo, TARDIS Wikia? I'm going to guess so and say it was probably called Atlantis. Which leads me to number 2. This was the first time Doc encountered Atlantis. 2 other classic serials, The Time Monster and The Daemons, also featured the Lost City. And I don't know for shizzle, but it seems as though it was destroyed in both of those as well. Differently, I should say. Spoilers, by the way, Atlantis is totally boned in this serial. So here's a fun circular trivia thingy, though. In the latest New Who episode, both that aired and that we reviewed on Who Back When, namely the Capaldi episode, The Magician's Apprentice, UNIT scans for the Doc throughout history and actually name-checks Atlantis, saying that there are 3 different versions thereof with his temporal footprint on them, so to speak. So those three versions are these three versions. Stephen Moffat, you're a true Whovian scholar. Well done, sir. That's all the introductory trivia we have for now. I'm going to jump into the recon. And I'm going to start with the opening credits. That's right. I'm going to jump straight to the end credits as well. So normally when I watch a recon, and normally when, well, most of us watch a Doctor Who classic reconstruction, or classic Doctor Who reconstruction, we watch a Loose Cannon Productions reconstruction. In this case, though, I'm not sure I did. Because at the start, there's no Loose Cannon ident. Instead, there's a Butterfly Effect ident. So I was thinking, right, so we have Butterfly Effect Productions or whatever to thank for this. And thanks, guys, you did a great job. But then, after the end credits, we get a different ident. We get... it says that it's a joint venture reconstruction. So, is this made by Butterfly Effect, or is this made by joint venture? Or is it made by Loose Cannon, and they just decided to have a laugh and call themselves two different things at the same time? I have no idea. Regardless, the reconstruction is phenomenal. Totally worth it. It's not a slog, it's not a pain. You can definitely get through it, and it is worth it. So let's jump into episode one. We open on the companions, all three of them, fantasizing about where and when they're going to materialize. And I'm going to kick off this Whovac When review with a soundbite right off the bat, along with not 1 point, not 2 points, but JK, I've got 2 points.
Please, let it be Chelsea 1966.
So Polly wants to return to 1966. Okay. So, A, I thought it was 1967 when she was first kidnapped. Is she hoping to go back an additional year in order to play the lottery or something? I don't know. And B, they've clearly just agreed to the kidnapping of Jamie because they know they can't escape unless they appease the Doc by giving him another young person to travel around time and space with. She keeps feeding Jamie all these tragic delusions like, hey, you know what, Jamie, we have no idea where we're heading, but that's the fun part. But in reality, she's praying for a safe return to what is erroneously insinuated to be her own time. Very sloppy. Anyway, okay, first anyway of the episode, guys, just saying. Jamie is totes blown away by the interior of the TARDIS. A note on this from TARDIS Wikia, by the way, is that because he didn't get to have one when he first entered the TARDIS in the last serial, The Highlanders, this, his second serial, is where he instead has his bigger on the inside moment. So let's all think about that the next time we whack off. Shazam, the TARDIS materializes on a volcanic island, and we're treated to two instances of the let's split up and meet back here in 10 minutes trope, back to back. First, the companions split from the Doc, then Polly splits from the lads. It matters not, though, because all of them are promptly kidnapped. Also, in case any of you are intent on visually scrutinizing the recon, 8 minutes and 5 seconds into it, we see what looks like a giant's camel toe, but which I suspect is just Ben, because they're giving him the shaft in this one. Tangent over, back to the gang. So they're in a lift. That's elevated to those of you in the New World, regaining their senses as it goes mega super duper deep underground. To indicate this, there's a standard depth or, like, pressure gauge or whatever behind Polly, and it has Arabic numerals and everything. Not the first time we've had that happen on the show, though, even the Daleks had one of those. When they reach the bottom, a guard armed with a spear, or maybe a trident, I can't remember, approaches them, and we get our first instance of racism in this episode.
Polly, you speak foreign, go and talk to him, ask him where we are!
And then we meet Ara. Oh my god, I'm really speeding through this one. Ara's this chick who works as some sort of Atlantean PA. Like, I don't know what her job is, but it appears to largely consist of walking around with baskets and doing whatever anyone asks of her. The guards is a total douche towards her, and the Doc defends her honor, so now she's a de facto ally. Bing bong, enter Lolem, one of the high priests of Atlantis, who immediately declares that the travelers are to be sacrificed to the goddess Amdo, but not before he gives Doc a brief chance to make a case for himself and his fellow travelers.
You have 5 minutes in which to make your point.
Sorry, say again, Lolem? Are you talking about those intervals of time that are divisions of days that in turn are governed by the sun that you can't see because you live in a fucking subterranean cave? You are? Oh, okay, just checking, carry on. Anyway, Doc has deduced that the great scientist Professor Zaroff is there, and he's done this solely based on the fact that they're offered plankton to eat. Even though, as far as the world is aware, Zaroff died ages ago, and Atlantis is at the bottom of the sea, so them having plankton for din-dins without the influence of some weird dead dryland scientist doesn't seem wholly inconceivable to me. Lolem doesn't buy his story, though, and Doc gets newfound ally Ara to take a note to Zaroff on his behalf. Now, let's assume something fairly distinct is writ on that note, yeah? Let's put a pin in that, though, and move on to our first line flub of this serial.
He led the field in producing food from the sea.
Bravo! So the gang is sentenced to death by Wheel of Fortune. They're strapped to this pretty elaborate death wheel that Indiana Jones and or Roger Moore's Bond would be proud to have failed to kill them. And then we cut to Zaroff, who looks pretty much exactly the way you'd imagine a mad scientist to look, and who speaks with a marvellous, generically foreign accent. He receives the note, and we get to see what it says. Returning to that pin now, by the way. Namely, vital secret will die with me. And it's signed Dr. W. Check the website. Check who back when for a screenshot of that. Okay, so I've got a couple of things to say here, Kelsey Breeze. First off, the second Doctor has signed his note Dr. W. That's pretty remarkable as far as trivia is concerned. Prior to this, Doc's only ever been referred to as Doctor Who once, namely in The War Machines, our review of which you should totes have a listen to if you haven't already, in which the Foe of the Month, supercomputer Voltan, says, Doctor Who is required. And outside of that abomination, only the Cushing movies actually assign him the name Who. So this is a rarity worth noting. Very interesting stuff. Secondly, what in the fuck kind of note is that, Dr. W? It means nothing. Literally nothing. At the very least, mention Zaroff by name in the note so he knows you've recognized his involvement. Whatever. Plan works, Doc gets released, meets Zaroff, and convinces him to also release his companions. Problem solved. Sort of. They're now going to become slaves instead. We learn that Zaroff faked his own death in order to go off the grid, and then escaped to Atlantis, where he received a super-advanced laboratory in which to plan the raising of the city back to the surface. Why he had to go rogue, how he knew where to find the mythical city of Atlantis, or how in the name of all that is holy the Atlanteans, who need I remind you are armed with spears, managed to provide Zaroff with a technologically super-advanced laboratory, is entirely beyond my understanding, and as far as I'm aware, left unexplored in this serial. Cut back to the companions and the end of episode 1. Ben and Jamie are taken to the mines, so that's pretty straightforward slavery right there, I think. And Polly is taken to see the plankton farms that are farmed by, wait for it, the horrendously freakish fish people who transform this episode from child-friendly fantasy and family adventure to unspeakable body horror. I mean, how inappropriate is that? It turns out the Atlanteans take undesirables and, accidental shipwreck survivors, of whom there are apparently plenty, and operate on them against their will, adding plastic gills to them and turning them into, quote, fish people. And guess what? Polly's about to go under the knife. Ara tells Doc about this, and he asks her to try to save Polly, which is a pretty big ask if you, if you ask me. Jesus, that's a sophisticated way of phrasing matters. Anywho, Polly is about to be turned into sushi. The surgeon goes, lights! And funnily enough, according to the recon, at this point, they dim the lights, although wouldn't they want more light for the procedure, though? No matter, we learn otherwise shortly. End of episode 1. Holy shit, I just sped through that one like crazy. Episode 2. Okie dokie, check this out. You can actually watch and enjoy all of episode 2, ladies and gents. That's right, episode 2 was recovered. Give it a Google. I watched it on Dailymotion. It seems to be where you can watch most of the recovered Doctor Who, or like classic Who episodes. And I have one of our listeners to thank for that, at Trenton Bless. Thanks, dude. I didn't know about this the first time I watched the serial, so I slogged through the recon. And I don't mean to dump on Butterfly Effect or whoever did the recon this time around, but watching the actual episode is infinitely more satisfying, if for no other reason than to see those ridiculous fish people. So thank you very much, at Trenton Bless on Twitter. That's Bless with two S's. Anyway, gonna speed through this one as well, I think. So Doc fiddles with some circuitry, which it turns out he's somehow, Time Lord knows how, identified as controlling the lights in the operating theatre, because now the lights in there go out completely. Oh yeah, sorry, I said earlier that in the recon it looked like the lights were dimmed. In the recovered ep, it transpired, they're in fact honed in on soon-to-be Sam and Mackie, Polly Wright. The surgeon gets royally pissed about this, and bolts up to the lab to complain to Zaroff, henceforth referred to as Sod Off. And while he's away, spoiler alert, obviously Ara is going to rescue Polly and lead her into the safety of nearby caves. A couple, no, actually, three interesting things to note back in the lab, by the way, are, well, I think so anyway, and let's face it, I'm pretty biased here, but the thing is, you're listening to the recent past right now, and if you wanted to affect what I'm going to talk about here today, then you probably should have tweeted me, at Punkin, or sent in a mini review of your own. Didn't do either of those things? Well, tough luck, amigo. Here's what I find worthy of mention. Numero uno. In the recon, the surgeon steps in and interrupts Zaroff during his megalomaniacal soliloquy, and Zaroff snaps at him and says, "Can't you see I'm talking to my friend here?" or something along those lines. I assumed at the time, as in when I was watching the recon, I assumed he was referring to the Doc. In the actual ep, though, we see him feeding a fish in an aquarium as he speaks, and it looks very much like he's in fact referring to the fish instead. Numero dos. Sodov reveals his entire plan to the Dockhammer now, telling him he is going to drill down to the center of the Earth and basically flood it with water. And he's got this super elaborate high school science fair model of the whole thing as well, though why he has that set up is anyone's guess. Anyway, in that context, we get this nugget of a soundbite.
The crust of the Earth is more than 100 miles thick. Below that is believed to be a white-hot molten core.
What do you mean, believed? You're a man of science, for goodness sake. Jesus. Yeah, that was the second point. The third point I wanted to make about this interlocution is that Doc thinks drilling to the core is impossible. I don't really get why, though. Not that many serials ago, human slaves were able to dig their way there by hand. So surely having a mad scientist with crazy fish person slaves at his disposal drilling his way to the core isn't all that far-fetched. Whatevs. Zaroff is totally bonkers and a gargantuan cockhat. His plan to resurrect Atlantis from the bottom of the ocean is a complete charade and is destined to end in the destruction of the Earth. And he's completely aware of that, as in, that's his intention. Ipso facto, Sodov est magnum douche nozzle. Let's go back to the mines for a sec, though, and see what Ben and Jamie are up to. And this really ticks me off, by the way. The Duchess was nearly human centipeded into a California role where the boys get to go on a wacky adventure following an easily escapable lax enslavement campaign. Pretty unbalanced. So to make matters right, I shall henceforth refer to Ben and Jamie as, and this follows Who Back When canon, I think you'll agree, BJ. So, BJ meet these two other slaves, Sean and Jacko, hence Sean and Jackoff. Actually, that's just going to confuse matters with Professor Sodov running the show. So fine, for the sake of ease, let's keep their real names. Sean and Jacko have been slaves for a while, but have somehow smuggled a compass into the mines, which clearly, I mean, you've seen Pulp Fiction, right?
I hid this uncomfortable hunk of metal up my ass 2 years.
They're planning an escape and are keeping it a secret, obvi, so within 15 seconds, they share their escape plan with BJ. Great work, guys, like ripped from the pages of a John Le Carré novel. Anyway, BJ joined their new friends and easily escape into some tunnels. I'm collating some of the plot points here to save time. They bumble around the caves for a bit, we get a literal cliffhanger scene as Jamie hangs from the edge of a cliff for a bit, then it all is well again. And meanwhile, in Escape City, Doc escapes from the lab and bumps into Ara because apparently she's always around when you need an ally, so now she helps distract Damon so Doc can chit-chat with Mr. Priest chap, Ramo. Not sure if I mentioned Damon before, by the way. He's like the senior cockhead on staff. And Ramo's... Did I mention Ramo? Oh my god, this is completely all over the place. He's another priest, whatever. The Ara thing, by the way, as in the fact that she's always around for some reason, might be explained by another piece of trivia, also mentioned on TARDIS Wikia. Apparently, the original script called for two ancillary female characters, Ara and Yvonne. But in the end, the two roles were merged into the one that we have in the serial now. Yvonne wasn't the only character to have been written out of the serial either. There used to be a female scientist named Steen helping Professor Sodov in his lab, but obviously she's no longer part of the storyline either. Whatevs. Have I started saying whatevs all the time as well? Shit. Alright. Doc and Ramo now bond over their mutual distrust of Professor Sodov and pop into a nearby temple where Doc demonstrates how the Earth is going to blow up by destroying a vase. Huge. I mean, huge leap of faith on the part of Ramo here. But yeah, he's picking up what Doc's putting down. So he gives Doc a priest cloak. Troughton's once again sporting a disguise. Seems like a bit of a thing. And anyway, off they pop to see Thaus, who's the leader of all of Atlantis. And here's an annoying thing that I forgot to mention a moment ago. While they were chatting in the temple, Polly was actually in there with them, hiding. But why? Why not step out of hiding when she realized that Doc was there and not under strict duress? Makes no sense. And now that they've left for their audience with Thaus, she steps out of hiding and is left on her own again, forced to wait for the next plot point to bring her back into the story. Cue the next plot point. A secret passageway into the temple is revealed. There's like this massive statue at the front of the temple, and right next to it is this fairly conspicuous-looking door. And that's it, by the way. That's the next plot point. Clearly, it's there to allow someone to go behind the statue and speak through its mouth in order to manipulate the congregation. Spoilers for later, guys. But who built that door? Or the head, for that matter. Clearly not all the priests. So who then, you ask? I'll tell you. The effing congregation. The regular dudes. So how the hell is it meant to fool anyone? You know what this is? It's the Batmobile Wayne Enterprises routine. Quick Chris Nolan tangent. Chris, I'm assuming you're listening. Are you telling me that Morgan Freeman built the Batmobile and, like, the Bats? Open brackets, copter, closing bracket. Obviously not. There were hundreds of engineers and workmen involved in creating all of those machines and gadgets. Yet, the whole world looks at Batman's kit and goes, where did he get all that from? We have no idea. What should be happening is all of those engineers and whatnots, not to mention the army brass that contracted Wayne Enterprises to build all that junk in the first place, they would instantly recognize the gadgets and suddenly Bruce Wayne would be totes effed in the A. That can be applied here as well. Hey, devout Atlantean lady god worshipper, build me a giant god statue with a door in the front so I can stand up inside it and pretend to be said god. Done that? Great, cheers. Now go over there and bow down in awe as I go inside the statue and pretend to be said god. Makes no sense. Whatever. The door opens anyway. Oh, effing anyways, too. Jesus. And out step BJ and their two mining pals. And along with Apo Polylogies, they all go into the statue as a bunch of people enter the temple. Episode cliffhanger alert. Doc fails to convince Faust of Professor Sodov's lunacy, and instead Faust hands Doc and what's-his-face, Ramo, over to the evil madman in question. End of episode 2, episode 3. I'm really going to speed through this one now. Doc and Ramo are brought into the temple to be sacrificed to the goddess Amdo as punishment, when suddenly, remember the Wayne Enterprises syndrome? The statue starts barking orders at the congregation. Wonder who that is? Yeah. So Doc and Ramo take this opportunity to escape into the idol, and when they've disappeared, the priests and everyone else in the temple look up and declare it a miracle, as though they had no idea the statue is actually just a glorified sound booth. Cut to Thanos' office. Thanos, by the way, leader of the Atlanteans, bears a striking resemblance to what's-his-face hunk number one, leader of the Thal, in the second ever Doctor Who serial, The Daleks. Definitely have a listen to our review of that one. So, anyway, cut to his office, where Sodov and Thaus are told of the miracle, and Sodov calls everyone a damn dirty ape, and orders the city to be scoured for the Doc Hammer. The good guys are planning stuff now, though. Sean and Jacko, who are nice guys, we, the audience, think at this point. Let's put a pin in that, shall we? They are to go speak with the fish people to get them to organize a farm strike, while Doc, Duchess, and BJ, they're gonna go kidnap Sodov. Not sure why exactly, but whatever. At this point, I'm thinking to force a confession out of him, maybe? Sure, yeah, that sounds plausible. Sure enough, that's exactly what happens. Well, sort of. We start in a marketplace where Troughton's now sporting his second disguise of the serial, namely standard Atlantean garb and Ray-Bans. Pretty hilarious. Screenshot on the website. And what follows is a Hanna-Barbera-esque montage that leads to Sodov being captured by the Scooby Gang in the temple. Meanwhile, it's pin time, because Sean and Jacko, the super nice dudes who helped BJ escape, are now heartlessly taunting the poor fish people for being less than men. So to clarify, okay, I'm going to put this into context. The fish people, they're just regular humans who were enslaved or captured, yada yada, and eventually they were surgically operated upon against their will and turned into freakish fish people. And they must have been robbed of more than their balls and their natural breeding apparatus and their ability to speak. Ugh, they must have also lost their spirit entirely, because surely you wouldn't farm plankton for the people who turned you into a monster. In fact, you probably wouldn't even want to stay alive. Buster. On a production note, some of the fish people are like proper fish people, quote-unquote, as in, they're fish the way that the Menoptera are butterflies. Menoptera, by the way, from the Web Planet. Definitely avoid that cereal, but definitely listen to our review. Anyway, so what I mean by that is, they're like, imagine a dude wearing makeup and wrapped in a shower curtain, right? But then other fish people are just regular guys and gals wearing diving goggles. Either way, totes worth it. These fish fingers take the cake. I love them. Sean and Jacko, however, total dicks. Have a heart, guys. Come on. These fish people, they've been through a lot. Either way, Sean and Jacko manage to convince the fish people to stage a strike. So now Atlantis is without plankton. And apparently, that's going to cause a widespread panic within minutes, which, spoiler alert, it absolutely will, and does. Blam! Doc and BJ head to the lab to check on the future of the Earth, while Polly and Ramo stay with a tied-up Sodov, who, surprise surprise, pulls the oldest trick of the book, pretending to repent and somehow convincing Duchess and El Padre to untie him, which in turn leads to the crazy vicious harpooning of Ramo by Sodov with a trident! You're welcome, children of 1967. Doesn't matter. Point is, now Ramo is mortally wounded and Sodov sods off with Polly as his hostage. Doc and Co head back to ask for directions or something, find the dying Ramo, so now they split up again with DB, that's Doc and Ben, heading to the lab, and Jay, that's Jamie, going after Sodov and Polly. Shazam. Jamie rescues Polly but loses Sodov in the caves, and then we cut to not hunk number one, Faust, and Sodov arguing about what to do about the fish dudes, and Sodov finally saying that, you know what, he doesn't care about them, and straight up shooting Faust dead. Final line of the episode.
Nothing in the world can stop me now!
which TARDIS Wikia points out is then echoed across Doctor Who. In fact, according to Wikia, Davros, whom we recently saw to return to New Who, says the exact same thing in Journey's End, and the Fifth Doctor does the same in the Caves of Androzani. So that's some pretty primo trivia right there. I think you'll agree with me, ladies and gentlemen of podcast land. End of episode 3, episode 4. DB, Doc and Ben, find the bloodbath Sodoff made of Thaos and his guards, and for some reason, not sure why at all, they take the mortally wounded, but still alive, Thaos back to the other set used in this serial, i.e. the temple. At some point around here, Doc makes himself guilty of a subject-verb disagreement.
Where's Polly and Jamie?
But now he has another plan. He's going to flood the whole city, which apparently is just a massive rock bubble under the sea, because that makes sense, I think, thus destroying the lab along with Sodoff's plans to crack the Earth like an egg. I really wish someone would explain this to me, though. So, Sodoff's plan was to drill a hole to the center of the planet, and the way I imagined the ensuing destruction was basically that in the process of doing so, or like maybe when they take out this incredibly long drill bit, water is going to flood into the hole, reach the core, evaporate, and then blow up the Earth from the inside. But drilling to the center of the planet would take a while, Nespa. So, as he could just press a button and destroy the planet, more or less, I'm thinking the drilling has already been done. But there are floodgates in the way, or just a tiny bit of drilling left to be done, or something like that. So what's going to happen when the city's flooded? Would it not cause water to shoot down the hole leading to the core? Or break the floodgates? Or, I don't know, I guess I can sort of buy all this, but I'd sort of like to know more about the whole thing. The whole thing. Like, are there fish people going to drill down there? Do they have a drill? What the F? Anyway, DB now plop off to flood the place, and meanwhile, panic breaks out in Atlantis because there's no food. And, I mean, just to clarify, there's been no new food harvested for like 5 minutes, maybe? Tops? But, you know, I'm getting off track. Ben pretends to be a guard and takes his fake prisoner, the Dockmeister, to the Atlantis reactor, because there is such a thing. Along the way, they encounter a real guard, who takes Ben at face value because of his disguise, and wants to know who the Doc is. So Ben explains that he's a wanted man, but no. God damn it, no. What? This guard doesn't know Doc is a wanted man? He's the freaking most wanted man in Atlantis. He's pretty much the only wanted man in Atlantis. This must be the worst security guard under the sea. And to further corroborate that, because Ben doesn't know the password to go into the lab, or the reactor, I mean, he just gives it to him. That's not how passwords work, guy. Jesus, someone fire this man and take away his pension and everything. Ridicule him in front of his children. This is ridiculous. God, it pisses me off. Alright, so whatever, they encounter another guard, and Ben now gives him the password because he has it now, and subsequently, he and the Doc are let through. This is ridiculous. Ugh. Blah blah blah, they Jason Statham a scientist in the next room and cause a reactor overload, so now Atlantis is pretty boned, and off they plop to the laboratory. Shit is going down now, and the city's starting to flood. Polly and Jamie, or PJ for short, they run off, but hit a cul-de-sac, so that's pretty scary. But they're gonna survive though, eh? Yeah, bet they are. Sodoff panics though and decides to blow up the planet in 5 minutes' time, which again, how? Clearly he's already drilled down to the core, right? Or whatever. DB pop in, there are some fisticuffs and gunshots. Sorry, I'm speeding through the action now. And in the end, Ben locks Sodoff in his own lab, out of reach of the kill switch and destined to drown. Doc wants to go back and save him, but a convenient cave-in blocks his way, so off they plop again, and we get to see Sodoff theatrically drowning in not quite enough water. I think that's a pretty accurate description thereof. Yada yada yada. PJ climb up to the surface, they reckon Doc and Benny Boy are dead, but obviously they're not. And then Ara, Thaos, and Damon arrive on shore as well, and they decide they'll rebuild Atlantis, but this time there won't be a temple in it. Boom. Our travellers go to the TARDIS and dematerialise while Jacko and Sean, the good guys from before, also survived, look on with a smile, which is a little silly because they really should be shitting themselves right now. Almost done now. Jamie's had his first proper adventure with the Doc and Co. and declares that it was a total blast. Polly, Ben and Jamie, or PB&J. Yes, Polly, Ben and Jamie, PB&J, mock Doc for having no control over where they go in space and time. So Doc now, like, he starts flicking switches and pressing buttons and says he's going to take them to Mars. And kablamo, suddenly they spin out of control. End of The Underwater Menace. Holy shit, I think I just broke a Who Back When record. That was a quick review. Which brings me to...
Review.
I'll at least attempt to keep this one clear and concise. I really enjoyed this serial. It's not quite as sci-fi as I like my sci-fi, but at least it's not a historical, and Troughton's still just as great at spouting technobabble as he was in The Power of the Daleks. In fact, let's start with Troughton. This is now our third serial with him, and I am thoroughly loving him. Still missing Hartman a little, I confess, but overall I'm quite pleased with the switcheroo. We have a younger, more dynamic, more mischievous Doc now, and I don't mean that to be surreptitious criticism of Hartnell, not at all. I'm just saying you can have too much of a good thing, and I'm pleased they switched one good thing for another. And I'm really enjoying Troughton's humorous side. The disguises, the sarcasm, those are great. The recorder, I wouldn't mind if it were dropped entirely, or shoved up someone's arse. It really does piss me off. There's a scene in this one, I didn't mention it at the time, in which Doc's hiding in the caves, and he really has to evade capture, right? And suddenly he just whips out his recorder and plays a few notes. And obviously no one hears him. It really ticks me off. It's completely unnecessary. I hate it as a plot device. In fact, fuck it. It's not even a plot device. I just hate it. Basta. Next up, the companions. PB&J. I think that might be my new favourite. PB&J are great, even though Polly is still a little bit more of a damsel in distress in this one. She doesn't get quite as much say in matters in The Underwater Menace as she did in The Highlanders, where she was like 127% take charge. She is good, though. Jamie does a great job in this one as well. It's his first proper Whovian adventure. And I really like how enthusiastic he is about the whole thing. I mean, I totally get why the first companions, Ian and Barbara, were at times a little reluctant to indulge in the Doc's misadventures because they were straight up kidnapped from well-established lives with careers and, you know, probably a foot on the London property ladder. But I have to say, I preferred when they weren't complaining that they were travelling to distant adventures. Ian and Barbara, I'm going to have to stop myself soon before I get into too much of a tangent here. They were at their best when they really enjoyed themselves. And to tie this back to Jamie now, I'm super pleased that that's how he's been so far. I get that this is just the beginning of his, in fact, record-long run as a companion on Doctor Who, but if this is any indication of where he's heading, then I'm mega-chuffed and completely on board. Benny boy. Yeah, Ben was good. Very gung-ho and take charge, full of initiative, and actually in a way a great parallel to Jamie. That may very well have been deliberate. Let's replace Ben with Jamie, but before we do, let's have them cooperate without any social friction whatsoever and demonstrate that they're super similar and whatnot. And it works. Totes. No lie. The bad guy. Sodov. Zaroff. Well, he's somewhere between an archetype and a stereotype. As an antagonist, he's practically a cartoon. I liked him, though, for just that. Apparently, and this is according to TARDIS Wiki again, in an earlier draft of the script, his desire to blow up the Earth was meant to be motivated by him having lost his wife and kids in a car crash. Okay, I get that. That's very, you know, Marvel bad guy-esque of him. But with so many kids watching the show in 1967, I'm not surprised the BBC omitted that backstory. However, for F's sake, replace it with something tangible instead. Why was he there? How did he know about Atlantis? Was he shipwrecked and got there by accident, or did he deliberately go there? Why did he want to go off the grid? Essentially, my beef here is, why allude to him having a weirdo Cold War backstory that kids won't understand or appreciate, but not give it enough meat on its bones for the adults watching the show to appreciate it either? Whatever, his plan is great, though. Blow up the Earth? Yep, I'm on board with that. Drill a hole to the center of the planet? Makes perfect sense to me. It's precisely the kind of scheme a Whovian supervillain, or a Bond villain for that matter, should have on their bucket list. Well done, Sodov. And well done, whoever wrote this episode. Or serial. Next up, Atlantis. I'll reserve judgment until I've seen the next couple of iterations of this lost city, but for now I'm going to say I'm not really impressed. I'm both impressed and let down. The body horror element of their culture is amazing and super creepy, but not fully explored and wholly inappropriate. The religion, yep, I guess I want to see some of that in there as well, but the statue and the sound booth thing from before, A, makes no sense, see earlier Wayne Enterprises reference, and B, kind of portrays them as uncivilized savages, which frankly is the opposite of how I consider them. I always think of Atlantis, both in theory and in fiction, as this incredibly civilized place which was home to science and logic and reason and impeccable manners, but that was then subjected to the elements and somehow sunk or what have you. In many ways, this place is the opposite of that. The fish people. Holy fuck, the fish people. Okay, let's rate this bad boy. I love this serial. I may have ended on a negative note there, but I really do enjoy this one. I'm going to give The Underwater Menace a 3.8 out of 5. And we've got a listener mini. Actually, before I read this listener mini, I have to say apologies if a bunch of you, or, you know, more than one of you sent in a listener mini for this one. If you have recently sent in a listener mini for an episode that we haven't dropped yet, then please resubmit it. Please go to whobackwhen.com, pop it into the contact form on there, and send it over one more time. Or send it straight to info@whobackwhen.com if that's your preference. Unfortunately, there was a little bit of a technical issue. It has been resolved now. For some reason, anything submitted through the contact form wasn't getting through to us. I've now rerouted it, so it's anything that you pop in there actually arrives in my personal email, and I know that that email works, so please send them in. I mentioned it on Twitter, and one of our listeners, yeah, you guessed it, it's SGamer82, he resubmitted, and here we go. This one is from, as I said, SGamer82, Steven. Steven says, a companion's first TARDIS adventure is always something special, and the Underwater Menace gives us Jamie McCrimmon, wondering too late just what he's gotten himself into. He holds up well in his first adventure, working well with Ben and Polly as they help the Doctor and defeat the mad scientist Professor Zaroff. I don't think he truly starts to come into his own yet, as he seems mostly content to follow the lead of his fellow travellers. Though I did enjoy his moment at the very end when he says he enjoyed the adventure, particularly the part where it's over and they're safe in the TARDIS. Okay, yeah, I failed to mention that point. Very, very nicely done. And yeah, I totally agree with you. That's exactly what I said. His enthusiasm, that's like one of the best things about it. All right. Stephen goes on, Zaroff is the true highlight of this serial as the hamtastic proto-Davros out to destroy the world just to prove he can. My favourite moment with him and the Doctor is when the Doctor calls Zaroff's bluff about the project going on without him. Zaroff acts cool and in control until the Doctor makes the weakness of his ego clear, at which point he abandons all pretense. As purely human villains go, Zaroff is definitely one of the top contenders. Holy shit, dude. I have not given Zaroff enough credit. You nailed it. He goes on, I also particularly liked Ara, the serving girl. Really? I think this is where we're going to disagree. While she seemed far more determined to help the Doctor and company at first for what's basically a moment's kindness, she is a vital part of the effort against Zaroff as the troops guide in the Atlantean tunnels. Okay, I'll agree that she was helpful. Okay, depending on how you see this, I like that she helped them because it was good and, you know, it helped the people that I morally support. But I feel like she wasn't given much substance as a character. Rather than be an individual in this story, she was a plot device. Anyway, that's my opinion. But yes, you're right. She absolutely, like, a moment's kindness totally worked out. Steven goes on. I'm sorry, Steven. I keep interrupting you, man. Like, I do apologize. All right, so Steven goes on. On the other hand, I don't feel much was done with the fish people. Oh, good point. It was an interesting concept, but other than as a threat to Polly and a means to distract Zaroff's efforts, they didn't have much to do with the plot. Going by an interview with Annika Wills that was at the end of the audiobook version I had, Steven says, the cast felt much the same. Also, entertaining though it was, the kidnap Zaroff subplot in episode 3 mostly felt like stalling to fill an episode until the climax. Okay. Oh, holy shit, I just spotted what you gave this, the rating that you gave this one. Nice one. Okay. Hang on, I'll get to that in a second. First off, awesome, you listened to the audiobook. I beseech you, Stephen, I beseech you, please go to whobackwhen.com and add another comment. I'll obviously pop your mini review on whobackwhen.com so that the good people of Podcastland can read and enjoy it. But add another note and say something more about the audiobook. Should I listen to it? I mean, should people listen to it? Should they watch the recon? How do they fare against each other? All right, so what you said about the fish people, that is a super good point. I stand by what I said before, that it's, like, it's mega inappropriate for a kids show. Because all of the themes in there are so super dark, and it's just so heartbreaking to think of, you know, oh, imagine having been turned into a fish. Fuck, man. But yeah, you're right, they were hardly in it, and they really should have been. They spent some time making kind of a costume for at least one of them. You're right, they should have done more with them. Very, very good point. The kidnap Zaroff subplot? Yeah, I think that was a red herring, and you're probably right. They were just stalling, that it was filler. But yeah, okay, anyway, I'm going to carry on, because the next bit is super, super duper exciting to me. Steven is approaching his rating, and he says, on the whole, I'm rating this episode a 3.8. Nailed it, Steven. Nailed it. He says, its biggest weakness to me, story-wise, being the lack of use for the fish people's plot. There was also a religion versus science subplot that could have been handled better. Yes, agreed, definitely. Given that at the end, Daemon blamed their religion for everything Zarov's science did. That's a super good point. I didn't touch upon that at all. Okay, here we go. He also concludes, finally, a few little trivia bits to round off this review. I'm excited! Number one, the addition of Fraser Hines as Jamie was a last-minute decision within the show. This is part of the reason for my comment that he hasn't come into his own yet, and also why the next serial, The Moon Base, will have Jamie doing what he does in the first episode or so. Number two, Joseph First used his actual accent when performing as Professor Zaroff. Really? Holy crap, I thought he was... I genuinely just thought he was hamming it up. I thought he was just adding random foreign accent here, you know. That's super interesting. Final bullet points. Stephen goes, at the time she recorded the audiobook featuring her, Annika Wills, played Polly, lived in a cottage not far from where they did location shooting for The Underwater Menace. From the little interview with her in the audiobook, the locals recognized Wills, but she had a hard time remembering just what she'd filmed, just what she'd filmed there until she recorded the actual audiobook. Well, awesome. The life of a celebrity, it's tough to keep track of these things. That's fantastic, though. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to high-five Steven, the Stevemeister, on Twitter. Follow him. He is at sgamer82. That's 82, the number. Steven, thank you so much again. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to say hello to me, you can do so on Twitter. I am at Ponken. Here's a soundbite of JD singing how you spell that.
P-O-N-K-E-N, Ponken.
Thanks, JD. The next episode is likely to be a New Who review. We will be reviewing Love and Monsters, one of the most hated and slated episodes of New Who, or of Doctor Who in general, in fact, of all time. Actually, and on that note again, if you've sent in a mini for that one, please resend it. That episode is already in the can. We have already recorded it, but we will sit down and record your mini now, because at the time when we sat down and recorded it, we had no minis. And most likely that was because of that fucking technical issue again. So, if it's a New Who, it is Love and Monsters. The next classic Who review, Eskimo 2 already gave it away, it's going to be The Moon Base. Send in your minis for that one as well. And if the next one is an audiobook review, which it is very unlikely to be, then it's going to be Wirren Dawn. And spoiler alert, I still don't like it. Okie dokie, that's it. Catch you in the next one. Rock on, be rad and excellent to each other, and ciao.
Kablamo! Did you enjoy the show? Then please do what the cosmos compels you to and spread the gospel of who back when. Tell your friends. Don't have any friends? No problemo. Tell some strangers. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen. All in one word. Are you on Google Plus? Then find us on Google Plus. That's plus who back when. And when you do, tell us why you're on Google Plus. Who Back When just got its very own Twitter account, no lie, so give us a follow. You guessed it, that's at Who Back When, all in one word. Check us out on SoundCloud, vote us up on Reddit, listen to us on Stitcher, and head on over to our website, whobackwhen.com, where you can leave a comment, submit a review of your own, and peruse our visual index of aliens, monsters, and more, which increases in kablamos with every episode. And lastly, give us a rating and review on iTunes. Not only would it make us super chuffed, and it really, really would, but as thanks, we will transmigrate your iTunes nom de plume into the credit list of trailers for fake Doctor Who audiobooks produced by Who Back When. Have a poke around our bonus episodes to make more sense of that. That's it. Rock on and be rad and excellent to each other. Catch your earballs in our next Classic Who Review, New Who Review, or, still funny, Audio Who Review. Ciao.
Who Back When?